Well, now I know what the YouTube headline's going to be
that
here.
That might be the best part of the whole interview.
Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team in. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. I didn't keep it real from the
So this Big Shot thing is super fun. We're having a great time. People are loving it. It's a little expensive. Just to say it, like, you know, at the end of the day, we are, you know,
I'm glad you said
we're, we're still stingy Jews here. Like it's really quite expensive. And you and I are funding this whole thing ourselves.
It's not
so
cheap.
I think at the very least, we should at least promote our tea business.
You all see the production quality.
Production quality is incredible. Yeah. We have an amazing staff, tons of producers, and it's a little expensive.
Yeah. So I'm obsessed with tea. I built David's Tea. I left many years ago. And Harley actually,
I can't believe we're doing
me.
This. This is perfect.
We're this doing this because you know, we have great tea, but we got to pay for Big Shot.
Perfect.
So Harley got me back into tea. I would curate these green tea collections for you. I'm in trouble sleeping in the evenings. I'm like, oh, you got to drink, switch coffee. You don't need 10 coffees
well,
a day.
If we're going to tell the story, let's tell the story.
Yeah, all right.
I had been drinking so much during the pandemic. I was by myself, obviously, like the rest of us were, and I was drinking a ton of coffee. And my anxiety was peaking. And actually, you had said you should switch off of coffee in the afternoon and move to really high-quality green tea.
The caffeine and green tea interacts differently. You don't get the big spike and crash.
Yeah, it's like a calm alertness almost,
right? Calm alertness. Yeah. And green tea is amazing, like really high quality green tea. And then,
but frankly, like most people, I had never had high quality green tea. Most of the tea that I had consumed in my life, it was like in a gift. I'd give a talk somewhere and they give me a gift box or some sort of gift package and there would be some like random tea bags in there. But I had never actually had really high end green tea. So you very kindly started curating this box of incredibly high-end, amazing green tea. And you also began to sort of, you know, jerry-rig these accessories for me. You'd say, drop it in here for 3 minutes and then take it out, make sure it's not steaming. And you just created this incredible tea setup for me. In fact, you know this, but next to my home office, I now have a little tea area that you actually created for me.
Right.
But green tea in particular and having you curate this tea for me was this incredible new element of my life because it allowed me to stay really energized, really focused in the afternoon without having any issue with sleeping.
And that was the inspiration for Firebelly. Finally, I was like, you're like, you know, let's do it. I'll be your partner. So we started Firebelly Tea. Most people want to take a tea bag and dunk it in the water. And the reality is there's this rich experience you can get with tea where you take the time to make it properly, whether it's green tea, black tea, oolong tea, herbal teas. We're doing something special with Firebelly.
Yeah, so Firebelly is the highest, the best tea. And actually, you got a chance to design every single accessory yourself.
Absolutely.
You went ahead and figured out, this is the best teacup. This is the best strainer for it. This is the best whisk in terms of how to make great matcha. But this is the best tea and the best tea products ever. And please buy our tea. We need a way to pay for more Big Shot episodes. So we don't need your money, but we would appreciate you buying some amazing green tea from Firebelly Tea. .com. It is not just a pitch. It is also the greatest tea ever, and it would make us really happy.
If you don't like it, we'll give you your money back.
No, we don't have to do that. We're not giving the money back.
Why not?
We're keeping your money, but you're going to love it.
You're going to love it.
All of a sudden, you're such a Big Shot. You're giving people's money back. Don't give the money back.
You'll give it as a gift. It makes a great gift.
It's a great gift. It's great tea. It's great accessories. You actually will really, really love it and allow us to pay for more of these Big Shot episodes. So that's our pitch. And all of you must be laughing wherever you're sitting right now watching this. We don't care.
We actually know tea well, though.
We also know e-commerce well, too.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
So we know e-commerce. We know tea. Firebelly Tea. Go buy some. Help us pay for more Big Shot episodes. So I know our audience. I know our audience really well. They're going to say, we love your tea. We want to buy from you. We want to support Big Shot. Is there a coupon code? Like, I'm going to get my aunt or someone in my family's going to call me and be like, I love the tea. It's really great. Can I get a discount? So is there a code we can give them?
Big Shot 15.
Big Shot 15. Okay. Code Big Shot 15 for 15% off our tea and tea accessories. And if you don't like the tea and you don't like the accessories, David will give you your money back. I will not. He will. That's it.
I'll give you your money back.
Okay.
I got you.
All right. I won't. So for those of you that are just tuning in, make sure to watch part one, if you can, before you watch part two, because part one is incredible. There's amazing stories. There's amazing context.
I mean, we talk about him having to win over his father-in-law, his first hotel, how he gets into the hotel business, but he ends up building a motel for someone else and does something completely unconventional that adds a ton of value that most people wouldn't think about doing. And now part two, I mean, this is just, this is incredible. I mean, we follow him through each hotel. Some of them don't go so well, and he ends up in hot water. He changes the entire Four Seasons business model.
He also goes really deep in part two in terms of his love and his relation with Rosalie. Yep. And how that love has been one of the superpowers, the secret sauces to not only his life, but to the entire, you know, Four Seasons empire. He talks about work-life balance in a way that, frankly, I've never seen anyone or heard anyone articulate that. He provides incredible wisdom in terms of how all of us should be thinking about our own joie de vivre, how we should be living a fuller life. The connection that he has to Rosalie is so inspiring.
Right. And we learn about some key moments in his life that caused him to look at his own philanthropy. And he ends up being a major sponsor. And frankly, one of the reasons why, I mean, Betty Fox, the mother of Terry Fox, the famous Terry Fox Run, once said there would be no Terry Fox Run without Izzy Sharp. And what he does there, and he creates this worldwide movement around it. And it's just remarkable.
Yeah.
And then, at the end, he hits us when we just...
You're not supposed to talk about this yet. You're not supposed to tease this out.
We got to tease this out just a little bit, no?
Okay, just a little bit. We ask him at the end to give us one final piece of advice. And his answer left my jaw and David's jaw on the floor.
On the floor.
I could not believe he said that, and he does. And honestly...
He's right.
I've been thinking about it for a long time.
Yeah.
That is one of the best pieces of advice that I've ever received in my life.
Absolutely. You gotta watch this.
What I think stands out more for most people that are gonna watch, most people that have experienced the Four Seasons, it is less about the real estate as a visitor, as a consumer at the hotel, and more about the service. And the service at the Four Seasons, and I wanna talk a bit about the Golden Rule. I wanna talk a little bit about how you cultivated this culture of incredible hospitality in a way that I don't think most people experience at any other hotel. When you first sat down, I told you that I've been on the road for a couple weeks now. And one of the things that's sort of like a breath of, like a warm blanket, is when I walk into a Four Seasons. I'm on the road and there's a lot going on. I'm stressed. I haven't slept in a while. It's airplane to airplane. But you walk in to this oasis that is the Four Seasons today. And yeah, the real estate obviously supports that culture. And the environment supports that hospitality. But there's something about the service that you experience as a guest at the Four Seasons that is unequivocally different.
And every single one, too.
And it's every single one has it. And there's a consistency to it, but each one has its own flavor.
Yeah.
When did customer service and when did that feeling of hospitality become such a cornerstone of the Four Seasons brand?
That took time not to envision, but to create. Mm-hmm. Because, as I say, we started with this hospitality host concept, and that's really what differentiated us in England and what I knew made us a success. Because in England at that time, if you went into the Dorchester, the Connaught, Claridge's, if you weren't dressed properly, you couldn't even come into the hotel.
Yeah, black t-shirt wouldn't work there. That's right.
And they looked down upon you.
Interesting.
You were checking the front desk, they would look up and say, yes, we might have a room for that. Attitude was very much social class. There was, Europe at that time, a social class. So our hotel was very different. London, we hired the people and told them this is not how we judge others. We're not the Dorchester, we're not Claridge's, we are the Inn on the Park. And so London was a repeat of the other hotels. Ian Munro, again, he wasn't going to run London because he was already running the other two hotels, but he hired people and explained, look, this is how we operate. We're not, judging people, and we treat everybody the same. It's not whether he's an important person or a worker. Everybody who is coming into the hotel or who works in the hotel, there's an egalitarian, equal approach to attitude about people. So London became the best hotel, and I knew why. Because we didn't build a grand hotel. I mean, when you went into these other hotels,
yeah, the Connaught or
they were palaces.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So we were a modern, you know, building, nothing impressive compared to them, but our people, the service, changed how people were treated in London.
Crazy. But you also took care of your own people. One thing that really stuck out for me is that Four Seasons employees are allowed to stay for free at the hotels, which is quite unique.
That's totally new. We did our research on this. No other hotel does that.
But those things happened over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How you create, you know, how do you help get people to respond to what you're talking about? What you're talking about, the service aspect. So that happened over many years. Mm-hmm. So, but London made it clear to me that service and attitude was the key for Four Seasons. So if you sort of fast forward, as we're starting to build more hotels and hiring people, I figured if this is going to be an industry that we're going to compete in, we certainly are never going to compete by being bigger. Because, you know, there's Hilton, Marriott, Hyatt. These were name brand hotels that controlled the marketplace. I said, we got to have something that's going to make us different that is sustainable. Because as you both know from your own business, if you don't have a sustainable competitive advantage, you're run over pretty quick. Because everybody sees what you're doing, they copy
it. They can just copy it.
And I can do it better. Yeah. So you have to have something they cannot do better.
Yeah.
Sustainable competitive advantage. So I'm telling our people, I think the only way we're going to be able to compete in this business is we haven't got the capital to become big. Is we're going to have to make our service our distinguishing feature. That is how we are going to compete and to be able to continue to grow. That got a lot of laughs and jeers and, yeah, sure, you know, that's... You're not really serious, are you?
It seems gimmicky almost.
He said, everybody does service. How can you make service? It's intangible. What are you right. talking about? So the senior people in the company really were, you know, wouldn't even think about it. Now, I'm in control of the company. As you know, control is a privilege. Yeah. And it's a great, you know, benefit if you don't have to ask other people. So I didn't want to, you know, I want to figure out how do you do it? How can we make service? And at that time, you know, we're talking now 1970s. McDonald's was the number one food, you know, fast food service company at that time. And I know their kids who work behind the counter always had this upbeat, pleasant, can-do attitude, you know, 16-year-olds who always had a smile and were doing things to help the, you know, always pleasing the customer.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a friend who was the president of McDonald's Canada, George Cohan. And I said, George, can I come and spend a day in your orientation when you're hiring new kids? So he said, sure. So I spent a day.
The McDonald's orientation.
Sitting down with all these kids at McDonald's orientation program, a whole day.
Like, you know, you're running a fancy hotel in London, England. You're sitting at the McDonald's orientation. I mean, think about that.
Did you wear the hat and the whole thing?
Like, I had hair, so I didn't wear a hat. So I come at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting with the same notebook they give you, and I'm listening, going through all the, you know, the hype that creates.
Yeah, would you like fries with that?
Yeah. Always offer the upsized drink.
And they showed the technical thing. But I noticed that the one thing that was the most important that they focused on was this film that they had that had to be 15 to 20 years old, the way that people were dressed, etc. But they were showing that film as the number one focus point for all these kids. Now listen, see what's happening in there and then I will explain it to you. So they focused on this one film to try to get these kids to understand what service was all about.
Like an instructional video.
It was only attitude, all about attitude. Everything came down to attitude, attitude, attitude. So I'm thinking about it, and I say, you have to get something then that sticks. Because at that time, McDonald's ads on TV changed every month. Every month, millions of dollars. And here on the most important thing that they wanted is the message.
One single video.
15 years old. Because the message was current. Never went out of style.
Timeless.
Timeless message. So I figured if you could have a timeless message to talk about your employees, then you don't have to change it. You don't have to keep reinventing the wheel as times change.
It becomes what you stand for.
So I take all our senior people and I say, I want you to come with me. And we're going to spend a day on McDonald's. We'll do it again.
Wow. You brought the Four Seasons. I brought the Four Seasons staff to McDonald's.
All my senior people. Seven of them. These are the senior people. The guy heads in hotel, development, everything.
Can you imagine going to your senior team, your executive team?
We're going to McDonald's.
Okay. I got this great idea. Here's how we're going to go and figure out hospitality. Okay. We're going to go. We're going to go sit in on the orientation for McDonald's with a bunch of teenagers. I mean, they must have been mind blown.
They said, you're joking. We got better things to do. I said, I know you do, but we're going.
Sure.
So you're the boss. You have to do what the boss says. So they go, and they're sitting, and they're joking and laughing and making jokes about it. And I'm sitting, and I'm taking all this in. So one of the guys says, look, they're selling hamburgers, and we're selling filet mignon. I say, I know what we're selling. It's how we sell it. So I knew we were in trouble. There's no way that I could get this message down to these people. Because that gave me the idea that the message that we might use is the golden rule. Because it's, motherhood. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. What could be simpler in telling an individual, that is how we are going to manage our workforce? Well, these senior people joked about it, laughed about it, and they said, look, it's philosophy. We're running a business. How are you going to get that across? I said, I don't know, but that's what we're going to do. So my first task at that time that I had to terminate all these senior people. Sure. I'm talking about people who were very competent. They knew how to run a hotel. They knew how to, all the business aspects. That's how they grew up. Mm-hmm. They were competent in their field. And, one of these is a very close personal friend. So I decided we're going to start over. And over the next couple years, I changed the senior people in the company.
They weren't willing to live the brand.
They would give it lip service.
Right.
But if they weren't going to walk the talk, if their actions were not going to speak louder than their words, how could you do it? Because if you can't get the message down to the bottom of the triangle, because those are the people who are talking to the customer.
Sure.
So if I can't get that message down,
it's never going to work.
Spitting in the wind.
Does that mean you actually had to part ways with a good friend of yours?
Good friend.
And so the sacrifice you're willing to make, I mean, that's a pretty big sacrifice to work with a good friend to say, look, this is not going to work out because I need you to live by these principles, not just repeat them to me lip service. There's this quote that I read that I really love. I'll read it to you. The reason for our success is no secret. It's about the Four Seasons, of course. It comes down to one single principle that transcends time and geography, religion and culture. It's the golden rule. The simple idea that if you treat people well the way you would like to be treated, they will do the same. You also said this, long-term success is never achieved on your own. The phrase a self-made man is a myth. All along the way, we need support. So not only did you codify the golden rule, but you ensure that everyone around you helped to disseminate it. How did you maintain that? How did you ensure it stuck over a long period of time, especially as you go to, you know, over 100 hotels around the world?
Well, the message that we started with, you know, I had people who did believe because that was their work ethic. This wasn't new. This wasn't something you had to invent.
Yeah.
This is how you have been brought up.
Yeah.
So the people that finally I did hire understood and believe and say, yeah, I buy into it. So we set out to talk about it rather than to put a memo out. So I and a man who was now head of hotel operations, his name was John Sharp, not a relative, just a very hardworking, bright into, he could have been a doctor. so that was the caliber of people. So he and I set out to talk to each hotel, met and talked to the senior people. And what I did is I wrote out a mission statement. That is still the mission statement of today. I didn't say I wrote it out. I talked to our head of marketing, Doug Hall, and said, Doug, I want to write something about, and it's all about the golden rule. And I want to talk about it, our goals, our beliefs, our principles. So I don't want to use the word the golden rule. I just want to talk about our goals, our beliefs, in a way that people can, hey, that makes sense. So I used that when I went out and talked to the hotels. Spat with the senior people, went through this mission statement, so to speak, and said, do you think you can live with this? Are you prepared to work with this principle? And most of them said, yeah, I think we can do that, but how are you going to get everybody else to do it? I said, well, you're the senior people in this company, in this hotel. If you do it,
I'll do it,
and you come across people below you who don't, make a change. So you, as the leaders in this hotel, are going to be responsible for making sure all the people below you are going to walk the talk.
They're the keepers of the culture. And if they can't do it, there's no way they can disseminate right. it to others.
And they said, what if they don't do it? I said, well, don't have to cut bait.
Yeah, this is what we stand for. You know, how you do things don't stop changing, but what you stand for never changes.
Yeah. So they said, you mean if some of the senior people, like they're talking about their peers.
Right.
Because not everybody necessarily buy. What about them? I said, the rule applies to everybody. So if you see things that aren't right, there are senior people above you who will take action. That took a few years.
Yeah.
But what's amazing here is this is, I mean, the backdrop of all this, I believe we're in the 70s now, right? Now, my understanding is the economy was not great in the 70s.
No, we ran
huge, huge inflation. You're building, I believe, a project in Vancouver, with the Eaton family, Cadillac Fairview, TD Bank.
Right.
You could have lost it all, right? The costs are rising. Yeah. You have a fixed contract price. Here you are philosophizing about
the golden rule.
And, you know, I imagine your CFO.
And the business is going down the drain.
And the business is going down the drain. I mean.
How do you get through that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, one doesn't necessarily conflict with the other.
Yeah.
Business problems. And you're right. Vancouver was going to be a disaster. And it wasn't like I knew that, because the principle that we're building Vancouver was already a formula of success. Mm-hmm. That's how I got London. That's how I, you know, other hotels that were built. You know, you start a hotel, you build it, you own it, you run it. Mm-hmm. That's how the first 6-7 hotels, we own the real estate.
Yeah.
Or we leased the real estate, which is like ownership.
Yeah, so you have the real estate, you run the hotel itself, all of it is Four Seasons.
Yeah, so okay. We're making money on the operation, we're making money on the real estate.
Right.
So it's good, yep. Very good business, until Vancouver. Because the costs, as you're right, inflation hit, and I'm responsible for the cost, and I don't have that kind of money. So I approached the three landlords, so to speak, and say, look, I can't go ahead with this. Spent all the money I've got, and clearly we're not going to be able to finish this hotel, so I'm at your mercy, and here are the keys to my company.
Wow.
So they said, look, we don't want to run your company, and we don't, and we want this hotel to be what you've already built. So I said, I haven't got the money to live up to this contract I've got with you. So they said, well, what if we reorganize? I said, well, that'd be different. He said, well, you go ahead and finish the hotel, and we'll talk about it after. So I went on spending money I didn't have, and after the hotel was finished, we had a meeting with Thompson, Fred Eaton, and it wasn't Eve Diamond or Neil Wood.
Wow.
Cadillac Fairview. I said, okay. They rewrote the deal to make it reasonable for me to continue operating the company and this hotel. So why, on why a handshake.
Why did they do that?
Because I lived up to doing what I said I could do for them. Vancouver became a phenomenal success. It was the center of Vancouver.
And at one point it looked like it wouldn't happen.
Right. And they had built, you know, these two office buildings that they wanted the hotel to be the feature.
Yeah.
And it was. It was spectacular. So I lived up to the promise of what I said I could do for them. And they didn't need my money.
Yeah.
So for them, we had made a deal and they rewrote the contract so that the rent we could pay would be reasonable. And that changed the company completely.
The business model of Four Seasons changed.
From that point forward, I decided we can no longer own the real estate of hotel. But I believed in real estate, and I said, but we should still take a participation in the ownership. So I arranged a business model that we would become a management company, but we would still take an equity position that we could afford. And I determined, now remember, I still don't have that kind of capital. So I worked out a formula that the management fees we would earn on a new hotel that we would build over 5 years would be X dollars, and I would take 70% of that because I didn't have an overhead.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew 70% of that fee is clear cash. Mm-hmm. I would go to the bank and say, look, over 5 years, I can pay you back out of these fees that I will earn if I get this deal. Mm-hmm. So if you lend me the money,
I can get the deal.
I could take a piece of the equity and probably make this deal. So that became the business model.
So a sweat equity.
Well.
Right, you're saying I'm gonna work the management fee and part of that's gonna be my equity.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm borrowing the money.
Right.
And putting it in, cash on delivery.
Okay.
Okay.
But the principle of the business deal was that if there was additional cash required, and if I had a 10% or 15% ownership, I wanted the privilege to reduce my equity or put up the cash. But I would never be obligated for money I didn't have. So my equity might go to zero.
Mm-hmm.
So I could lose my equity.
Right.
But I would have the management contract, which would give me the income. So,
but that meant that you effectively, if you're going to be the management side of these hotels, you have to be the best at the world, in the world, at that management.
Well,
You have to earn the right to be the
right.
management.
Because they can change the name on the
Because
on
they, can,
the door.
They can say it's not going to be Four Seasons, it's going to be something else right now. That's right.
Yeah.
So you have to be so good at the management piece that everybody wants you to be their partner.
Well, at the beginning, remember, we've, you know, 7-8 hotels. Who are you? What do you do? So you make a deal.
Yeah.
I'm a good salesman. I know that. I make a good first impression, and I never disappoint. So I live up to what I say, and I can be a charming partner.
Yeah.
So I've been able to make very good business relations that exist to this day. So I could make a good business deal, which I did.
Well, you don't just make a good business deal. You've made good business deals across multiple different cultures. I think one of the things that I found fascinating in Rosalie's book is she describes you going to Japan to talk to, I believe it was the Industrial Bank. Yeah. And he starts telling you this story about the shoguns and how they would exchange their wives as sort of a guarantee that they wouldn't be held hostage. And then at the end of this this nice lunch or dinner, he turns to you and goes, I really want to meet your wife. And you said, as long as you don't hold her hostage. And he bursts out laughing. He says, we're going to do lots of business together.
Yeah.
I mean, every culture has different norms, different different senses of humor. How are you able to do that, not just be a charming salesperson in your own environment, but then to take that and do it across all these different countries and cultures?
I think it's my upbringing. I've never felt uncomfortable being in relating and dealing with people at different levels or at low levels. So it's just, I think, a personality trait, combination of my mother and my father. My mother's chutzpah, which gives me the confidence and belief, and my father's good nature.
Yeah.
Always, always nice to be around, always positive, always never a negative word out of his mouth. So I think that combination of a personality has allowed me to make good impressions.
Yeah.
And I've done that through dealing with the most tough business people out of New York and to the more gracious people in the Far East. So it's been a part of my DNA.
Yeah.
But the business model is what has got us through all these economic downturns. So when interest rates went up to, you know, 21% in the 80s, you know, you're not caught with having a financial burden that you have to worry about. The pandemic, you know, hotels closed. If we were responsible for the ownership, we'd lose those hotels. But the partners who own those hotels have a lot of, you know, deep pockets. So the business model of becoming a management company, we still will put money into the hotels that we're building to this day. We'll either invest in equity or invest in a management contract. So we're still, I'm still a believer in real estate. I know if you can hold on to it, if you've got staying power, you will always make money in real estate. It's only the time that you're forced to sell, if you must, that you lose.
Do you think that's still the case going forward? Do you think that's a timeless principle?
It's timeless. Because real estate's a diminishing product.
Yeah.
There's it's used up.
That's right.
You know, look downtown here.
They're not making more land.
Right. So now that's gone. Now where else do you go? So the ownership of that land will appreciate over time, always. The buildings might depreciate and give you a tax write-off, but the asset itself will always continue to increase in value.
By the way, we have a tradition on Big Shot where we make a deal on every episode. So we'll talk after about how we can get in on one.
I think actually we just need Firebelly tea across all the four seasons.
Yeah, that's
Izzy, I want to ask you something sort of on the personal side. David and I have been entrepreneurs like you for most of our lives. I started my first DJ company when I was 13 years old because I wanted to be a DJ for bar mitzvahs. Nobody would hire me, and so I hired myself. So entrepreneurship is something that is not only a passion for us, but also how we've built our lives and our livelihoods and support our families. One thing that we struggle with sometimes, we both have incredible partners in our life, women in our lives, our wives, Emily for David and Lindsay for me. And often we struggle with the balance, if you can even say that. I mean, it's more like, you know, we don't really believe in work-life balance. It's more like work-life harmony for us. We try to combine all these things. But one of the things in preparation for this interview that David and I kept stopping and like having kind of these sidebar conversations about is your relationship with Rosalie. And what we'd love to learn from you is how do you balance being a great entrepreneur, a great leader, with also being a great father and a great husband? I'm not sure. I mean, we try our best. We're doing whatever we can.
It's a constant adjustment.
It is. And we sometimes feel guilty about not being there all the time. David has three kids. I have two kids. Can you talk a little bit about how you've sort of
design that in your life? Because there's something so profound. You read it in the pages of Rosalie's book, but any research anyone does on Izzy Sharp, your wife comes up. And you, again, you talk about that there's, you know, there's no self-made man or self-made person. I'd love to know from you what we can learn from that, because there's something so special about what you and your wife have.
Well, you're right. I think the relationship that you have, that is the most, that's the most important support you will ever get, is from the partner you have chosen to live with, regardless of who that is, and your family. You know, there's nothing more important to everybody. It's just innate. You cannot ever, ever give up the love and devotion you have for your children. I've often said the only true love that exists is the love a parent has for their child. And it doesn't go the other way. It's involuntary. You cannot help the feelings you have for your children.
It's biological.
It's there.
Yeah.
It's there. And a woman has a stronger connection. That umbilical cord never gets cut. So that's what we're all faced with. Now, relationships you have with your wives or husbands changes. And that's what breaks up a lot of businesses and marriages. Mm-hmm. If you're fortunate, look, when you get married, you're young. What do you know?
Right.
You know, it's sex, it's emotions, it's, hey, you know, you're good looking and all that. All these things go into those first of relationship building. And it's a question, doesn't change. Mm-hmm. But what else happens in the course of your growing up together? And I think the fact that if you continue having the respect and appreciation of your spouses, appreciation, never losing the fact that they're special, the same feeling you had because of the hormones which drove you to mm-hmm. get together, does now it move into a different level of knowing the person, who the person is, and continuing to appreciate and respect that. So when you ask them a question, you're talking about something, you really want what they you want to know what they have to say. You're not just saying, you're being polite to say, what do you think about this? You want that answer from that person. And I have found over the years that appreciation gets stronger and stronger. This morning, when I'm talking to Rosalie and doing something, and she does something, it just had a string of my heart was pulled. Because I've never stopped appreciating who she is and what she has given me in terms of my life by what I've learned, her support, and as you say, your priorities. And I didn't have the experience and or understanding of having my priorities in the right place, bringing up the kids. Fortunately, Rosalie filled in the gaps. Like when I talk about it now, the regrets I have are that I left a lot of that part of my life on the cutting room floor. Yeah. I know that. Yeah. The kids say, no, Dad, you're wrong. You're always there. And Rosalie now says, as much as we, in her book, she says, as much as we try to tell him,
he doesn't want to.
His regrets are still there.
Yeah. Could you have done it otherwise?
No. You're young. Your priorities are all in a different mode of what you're trying to do. You know, did I have to take all those trips to London? Of course.
Yeah. Deal wouldn't happen.
That's the result.
Yeah. You show up.
Could I have said, no, I'll make it a telephone call and we can talk about the same thing? Because when I used to go over, we didn't accomplish anything. I would have lunch, we'd talk, and we'd go back. So, unfortunately, I think I left a lot of the role I played as a father, I believe. But I was there, you know, doing my job when I could. And the kids, don't agree with me. Like sometimes when I'm holding a town hall and the kid, one of my sons in the audience, and that question always comes up. And he said, look, Dad, I'm here. You were wrong. So I think they see it differently. And it's tough. You know, you don't build a business by going from 8 to 5 in the morning, in the afternoon. Yeah. It's a 24/7 job. And, when they always say, how can I learn to become an entrepreneur? You can't.
Yeah.
You're born with that innate gene. Because that's what drives you.
Yeah.
And as much as you have the other priorities clear in your vision, some people are better at it than others. So I say it's tough when you're young to know what you're the right thing to do at the right time. But having a spouse, partner that's there to fill in for you, you probably take advantage of it.
Yeah. Right, I mean, they're so patient, right? They and I imagine it's a two-way street, but you know, from when you're 20 or whatever, when you meet, you're developing all along the way. And I would think sometimes one partner develops a little faster and then this one catches up and then,
Yeah. No, she's never, Rosalie, from my point of view, has never been negative, has never asked me not to take that trip, ever. Knowing full well that I'm going to be gone a week and she's going to be 4 kids and 3 in diapers,
Right.
Without having help sometimes. So
you guys were partners, though, and so it allowed you to sort of divide and conquer. We talked about Rosalie, and obviously in the book, one of the things that comes out that's so clear is her pride in you and how proud she is of what you've built, what you've built together. Were your mom and dad around to see the success that you built?
They were. They were to the point where we were, not where we are today, but enough of a difference in life for them to be see it. And Shebnachas.
Yeah.
So they
Shebnachas is what we're all trying to achieve for our parents too.
Yeah. So that's, part of the gratification.
Sure.
Your dad, I believe, lived till the early 80s, right?
My dad lived to 103.
Wow. Incredible.
And, he did enjoy the
bit. I mean, you look fantastic and you can see, I imagine you get it from him mostly.
Yeah, we got good genes, longevity gene that we both inherited. Goes a long way to help you. They did. They were around to see the glamour of what Four Seasons became.
And what about the philanthropy too? I mean, you've done so much on philanthropy, whether it's your donations to Mount Sinai, Sick Kids, the Performance Center for the Arts, which we both
took a walk last night to go see it, and just in preparation for this.
We're going to meet this guy tomorrow.
It's such a beautiful building.
It's gorgeous.
It's incredible.
But
there's one that we really want to ask you about.
Yeah. So, I mean, most people I don't think know this, but Terry Fox, famous Canadian, once said, without Isidore Sharp, there would be no Terry Fox run.
Right.
I'd love to hear the story on
how
that
happened. You enough in your plate at that point?
Right,
there
exactly.
wasn't enough going on in your life
not
to start
enough
the
going
Terry Fox
on.
Run?
You had come off a difficult time. You're building this business. And here you hear about this kid who's running. And nobody's really donating, I believe, at early days.
No, you're right. I guess because of my problem that Rosalie and I faced with our son, dying from cancer, that's something that's with you forever.
How old is your son when he died from cancer?
17. Turning
17 18, years old, wow.
So the loss of a son for any family is an unnatural event, especially when they're young on that. And that's with you forever. You over time you're able to, and when that occurred, we had 3 other kids, and the trauma and tragedy, you've got to make sure it doesn't get worse than what it is. So both Rosalie and I independently didn't talk about it, But independently, we both approached it the same way with, we can't cause this to be hurtful for our other kids. So we sucked it up as best we could. We didn't cause each other a problem, because a lot of times families break up because each person is so deep in their grief. But we didn't. We weren't sharing or displaying grief. And what you do, you build up a shield that when you know you're going to a social event, a bar mitzvah, a wedding, etc., you know you're going to hear stories that are going to affect you. So you really build up that preparation, knowing there's going to be things said that's going to bother you. But sometimes there's something happens you're not expecting, and the tears flow. You just can't stop it. So I think I, like a lot of people who have been affected, have a different connection when you deal with cancer. So with Terry Fox, what he set out to do and what he talked about, the suffering that he wanted to do something about so the pain would stop, resonated with me in a way that I figured, we got to help this kid. So I had somebody who went out and tracked him when he first started. Her name was Bev Norris. And she reported back, she said, it's terrible. People don't believe him. They think it's some gimmick, advertising stunt. How could a kid on one leg run across Canada? And she said, cars are almost running him off the road because they think he's just some advertising. So I decided we'd try to do something. It'd be more visible. And put ads in the newspapers and magazines, which said something like, Four Seasons will donate $10,000, and I invited 999 other companies to join with Four Seasons to make it a $10 million run.
Amazing.
And put ads in the newspapers, and he heard about it, and then called me on the middle of a highway somewhere, I guess. And in a voice, you could hear the tears. His voice was breaking down, saying, I was just ready to throw in the towel, but if one person cares enough, that's all I need. And he kept going. And then it did take off. People started saying, hey, look what this kid has already done. A marathon a day. And he hit
auto. With one leg.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So when he came to Toronto, I did meet with him, and I held a big luncheon for him, an event that went well, and told, I said, look, Terry, this is bigger than you ever thought. This is much more than Canada. This is a world event. We should talk now and organize what could be done when you get to Vancouver. And what was remarkable about this 18-year-old kid, he was a mature adult. And he just said very calmly, no, I don't want to think about that now. And I knew then.
I'm not going to make it.
He's not going to make it. Because he was running under pain.
Yeah.
And you could almost feel it when you're with him. So when he had a stop, I spoke to him and his mother and suggested that, if he wouldn't mind, I'd like to organize to do something and that we'd maybe start a run, not to finish his run and not to make it a marathon of hope, but just a Terry Fox annual run of raising money for cancer, and sent him a telegram outlining what we would try to do. He liked that idea. And he said, but I don't want anybody to finish my run. And I said, no, we'll just make it a family affair. So now it's going on to his 43rd year, I think.
$850 million.
$850 million.
Is what the Four Seasons Terry Fox run has raised.
And what occurred to me this year,
wow.
I never thought of it until this year when I was making a speech to our crowd, that's an additional $850 million that would never have been raised had we not started this Terry Fox run.
Yeah.
So in Terry's name,
almost $1 billion has been raised.
Remarkable. A young kid set out on an improbable journey and
becomes a Canadian legend, worldwide legend.
Global legend, yeah.
Yeah.
He's our Daniel Boone.
That's right.
You know, people that will talk about him for generations.
And if he doesn't strike a chord in your heart and you don't end up giving him or giving $10,000 for and inviting the other 999 businesses in,
happens. Yeah.
He may be quits. And
could have quit.
Izzy, I want to finish up with a question that we ask all our guests. And we started by talking about why we're creating this archive of Jewish entrepreneurial stories. But there's one sort of theme, term, idea that keeps coming up, which is the idea of chutzpah. And I'm curious, in your own words, Izzy, what does chutzpah mean to you?
I think it's not a personality as a braggart. I think it's a personality that you have a subliminal belief in yourself, that when you believe with what you're doing will work. Even though there's skeptics all around you telling you why it won't work, all the reasons that they can give you. But that doesn't stop you from saying, I know what you're saying is true, because what they are telling you are facts of the past. And you say, I know. You're not telling me something I haven't heard before. But I think this will work. I think it's not going to deter me. You have an inner feeling, and you don't know where it comes from. But it's part of you. In terms of your ability to have the courage to be able to persevere against all the odds and take and accept the consequences. Because, if you're going to roll the dice with everything you own. And
you may lose.
You may lose.
May lose. So I think that comes from your genes that you inherit. It's not what you learn in school or you can read in books. It's your natural personality that gives you the drive and the energy. As you well know, when people say, as Rosie, I think, said in her book, I could go to 10, 12 hotels in, 15, 16 days. And she said, I marvel at your physical energy and intellectual capacity to always be on. And I say, Rosalie, when you're doing something that you enjoy,
it might not work.
You don't really get tired.
Yeah.
It's something that just human nature has given you that extra strength to continue. And so it's an innate belief that you're born with in terms of how you develop as a child. And I think it's not like being a narcissistic Trump. Mm-hmm. Not that at all. You don't have an ego. It's not like you're doing this because, hey, look how good I am. Mm-hmm. So I think it's personality. And I have to say, our Jewish heritage goes back a long way that gives us the belief of can do, If it doesn't work, so be it.
Yeah.
But I'm going to give it my all. Sometimes I tell the kids when they all ask these questions, I say, look, in your vocabulary when you're doing things, take the word if out of your vocabulary. Don't say, if I would have studied, I could have passed into honors. If I would have practiced, I could have run faster. That's bullshit. If is a crutch. You're afraid to say, I gave it my all. Yeah. I ran as fast as I could. I came last, but you know what? That's good. I know how fast I can run now. Yeah. So that is what the chutzpah is.
Beautifully said.
You're able to say, I'm giving it my best, and I'm making no excuses. If it doesn't work, I will say, hey, I wasn't good enough.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's okay.
This has been an honor and a privilege. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, David and I, as
what caused you guys to start to put this together?
Well, first of all, you have to give me a second here. I'm a little bit taken back by what you just said. David and I are proud Jewish entrepreneurs, but we attribute a lot of our success on standing on the shoulders of giants. You're that giant, whether you know it or not. This office that we're sitting in right now, the companies that we have built, the projects that we work on together, we have modeled our ambition and our own ability to imagine what is possible based on what you did.
Yeah.
Watching you build what is truly one of the greatest companies, one of the greatest brands on the planet.
Our bedtime stories and dinner time stories were about the Izzy Sharps of the world. And all these amazing, incredible Jewish entrepreneurs who came from very humble beginnings to become titans of industry and did so against this backdrop of anti-Semitism that, you know, we haven't known to the same degree as you did in you know, the 50s and the 60s and even the 40s a bit, I'm sure. And, you know, what's our excuse, right? If you're able to overcome all these, you know, whether it be poverty or these difficulties, anti-Semitism, people barring you from various institutions, can't get the right jobs. I know one of your architect jobs, you face some anti-Semitism. And then you're able to take all that and it doesn't stop you from keeping going, showing up every day. You know, we have no excuse. And I think that's inspiring. It drives us. You know, we want to be that next generation of Jewish entrepreneurs that contributes to the world and makes a difference and we can has have a positive impact.
If we can have half the impact on the next vintage of Harleys and Davids that frankly you and some of your peers have had on us, we think that that would be a really great thing. And frankly, there is no archival of these stories. You can find bits and pieces of it, but there is no one place where you can go to find out about the stories of the world's greatest Jewish entrepreneurs of the last century. And so sitting down with people like you hopefully creates this this time capsule that we can share with many more generations that come after us. And hopefully they start the next Four Seasons and the next Shopify's, the next David's Tees. That is, to David's point, those are the bedtime stories that we grew up hearing about and listening to from our bubbies and our zadies. And that's why I say this is partially a documentary, but it's also partially just sitting in a Jewish deli kibitzing and talking about what got us here.
It's a little early for smoking, so we didn't,
but,
you know.
That's right. But we are so grateful that you spend time with us. You have a million other things you could be doing now. And it is incredibly meaningful to us that you decided to spend a couple hours with us today.
So let me leave you with some good advice.
Please,
please.
That will serve you well. I had played a lot of sports my whole life. You know, I went to school not to learn, but to play games. And it was my life. So after college, et cetera, and I'm trying to still find what am I going to do to give up team sports, I got to start staying in shape. So we built the first, you know, fitness institute. That's what it was called, in the park. So I used to go in after work and work out. And the person we hired to run it was Lloyd Percival, who was Canada's foremost track and field coach. And he put me through training programs and I got into the best shape in my life. I mean, physically, stronger, everything about it. And he explained to me, you know, now look, this is as good as you will ever get, but don't worry, it'll slowly go down. But if you keep it up as much as you can, it'll take a long time before, you know, you do much less. And he said, besides, if you keep physically fit throughout your life and mentally alert, because the brain is a muscle, if you don't use it, it'll atrophy. So keep the brain going as you always have. And I guarantee you, you'll never lose your sex life. He's right to this day. So what else do you have to tell a 35-year-old kid?
It's perfect. To get an organ, that's right.
Stay in shape, exercise your brain, your sex life will be okay. That's pretty good.
Sounds good to me. I'm in.
That's good.
Sign me up.
Maybe that's why you've been married longer than pretty much every one of our guests. But by the way, a lot of our guests have not been married this long. Many of them are on multiple spouses.
I know, but that's the point.
Yeah.
Sex is a strong part of people's lives.
Sure.
And the point is, if you have a companion who believes in it as you do, it goes on indefinitely.
Well, now I know what the YouTube headline's going to be
that
here.
That might be the best part of the whole interview.
Izzy, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team. Yeah, I done kept it real from the jump. Living at my mama's house, we'd argue every...